But are you reaching out to the landowners?
I can't understand that.
And what about properties where the drinking water is simply not contaminated? What value, I mean, we test our water, our domestic water, and what ownership do I have in this problem that may exist 10 miles from me? I mean, and why do 19 people have the right to decide what hundreds of others are going to be saddled with? I mean, I can see how it expedited things. You probably got more than 50% of the land. Want to negotiate with them something that the other 50% of the land, or the 49% of the land, can't argue with? It seems unfair, to at the very least. And then drinking water, I mean, I do know farmers that have nitrates in their drinking water and have put in reverse osmosis systems to mitigate that. I mean, are they going to be responsible for other surrounding properties? I mean, I just think there are a lot of unanswered questions from the point of those of us on the ground that are going to be impacted by something we haven't heard of. Thank you.
Thank you for your comment, and perhaps when we have heard the other additional two-speaker card, you know, if staff or some of you would like to shed some clarification, you know, that will be welcome. So next will be Mr. Shimmick.
It's still morning. Good morning, everyone. My name is Steve Shimmick, and as always, thank you for your service to the people of the Central Coast. You're essentially volunteers, so thank you. I'm here today with comments on behalf of the Otter Project and the Environmental Justice Coalition for Water, who apologizes for not being able to join you today. We're supportive of the good intent of this, but we do have some suggestions. We have 4 points we would like to make. One, we believe the ability to enforce under the agreement is confusing. Section 5.1 offers safe harbor from cleanup and abatement orders, cease and desist orders, and adds that the provision should be interpreted very broadly. Section 5.2 says that enforcement can occur, except in efforts to provide drinking water. These statements are contradictory and confusing. I have little doubt that a grower that's enforced against is going to point to 5.1 that offers them safe harbor, and a state will point at 5.2 saying, well, but no, there's this qualifier. This confusion could have been and should have been completely avoided. Two, the agreement offers confidentiality and anonymity. This agreement is inconsistent with the outcome of Zamora, which also dealt with nitrate contamination of groundwater. While we can agree that the judge's ruling most likely only applies to the facts of that case, the judge's opinion and intent was clear and consistent with Porter Cologne. Data and names of responsible parties should not be confidential. Three, we have concerns about the many details of how the agreement will be implemented. Specifically, we request that, and this is a little bit of a list, A, there be clearly defined performance metrics, timelines, progress reports, and consequences for poor performance. B, all individual households served by one system must be enrolled for that system to be considered served under the agreement. C, there must be clarity regarding the quantity of water that must be delivered. D, there must be clarity on what constitutes commercially reasonable steps to contact and provide replacement water. E, there must be specific outreach requirements and plans for homes served by private domestic wells. And F, there must be clarity on length of replacement water service. Signups will probably take many months, and service ends March 28th, 2018, unless extended. And then my final point, number four. This agreement is a big deal, a very big deal. It's a good thing, but it's a big deal. And we feel that this agreement should have come out before the full board and to the public for comment and a transparent decision. Water is a public trust resource, and the scope of this agreement, its importance, and its concessions, such as confidentiality, should have been presented and discussed transparently, and the public should have had the opportunity to weigh in. Thank you, and thank you for the extended time.
You're welcome, Steve. Thank you. And I know that ample notes were taken, so you know we will get some feedback shortly. And then the last speaker card I have is for Madeline. So first, my apology for not welcoming you more officially. I got sidetracked.
Well, I'm not in the same official capacity that you know me. This is Madeline Glickfeld, and I'm here representing the UCLA team that is contracted with the state board to do a pilot study for a new technology that will bring low-cost treatment to disadvantaged communities. We've been working on this for 5 years. We chose this region because of the dedication of your board, your staff, and the County of Monterey to solving these problems. And we're what I wanted to do is say to you how important it was for us to see this settlement agreement and to report to you on the extent of work and to report to the staff on the extent of work we've been doing. We fixed the plumbing in our communities, two of them, Santa Teresa and Blue Rock Apartments, are going to get replacement water under this project. And our third community, Prior Forms, is a labor camp that's run by Huntington Farms, which is a party to the stewardship group and is providing their own water. It's very hard to keep all of this stuff straight in the community's mind. So we work with them every month talking about what we're doing. So what we've asked of the staff as they start to evolve the implementation of this is that we be the face of outreach because we have these relationships. We want to be able to bring an agreement that we feel comfortable recommending to our communities because they're not too thrilled about what they've seen so far. You have to remember that a lot of these residents are farm workers working for the people that are here. So it's already somewhat intimidating if there are conditions for them. And I think your staff and the enforcement group really do get that. They understand that. And I'm very optimistic. Second thing is that we wanted you to know that we've done extensive testing already. That testing is already reported to the regional board and the state board. It's public information. Farmers can have access to it. And when we finalized our agreement with the regional board, it's going to be a very detailed monitoring program on a monthly basis for a year. And they will have access to that as well. So I think the two big issues that we saw were the agreements that people were asked to sign and the right to get onto the property to do testing by themselves. It really isn't necessary. So I look forward to coming back here for John to make an opportunity for me to give you a full report on what we're doing. We're pretty excited about it, and we are anxious to get started. Thank you.
Madeline, before you go, actually you did refer to the fact that we do know you from a different context.
You do.
So could you please identify for the rest of us?
So I'm on the LA Regional Water Board, and the way I learned about this problem was when we had we have our annual regional boards meeting, and I was so affected by what is happening with these rural communities that I brought our best groundwater cleanup person from UCLA who's doing amazing work way ahead of its time. We literally have the equivalent to an automated car that can be managed remotely and managed much cheaper and doesn't require uninformed people to manage a sophisticated system. So we're anxious to get on the ground, test the system, deliver the water, and find out how much it costs to operate the system so we can find out what the operating costs are. This agreement gives us the opportunity to have a dialogue with the Agricultural Stewardship Group about what we think is going to be a much cheaper way of helping these communities to have a permanent water solution.
And Madeline, this ties actually to our chairs meeting that we had, and you know, Mr. Robertson participated at, where one of the presentation, which was organized by San Diego and Henry, was how can we leverage more technologies to help water quality, and this certainly falls right in line with it. So thank you again for
coming.
Thank you,
and
today.
I'll be back when we have something to bring you together. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Madeline. So at this time, I would like to ask our team to perhaps provide some additional clarification to some questions or comments that were made by the last speakers.
So I thank you, Chair Wolf. I think this is going to similarly be a tag team effort, because Chris holds a lot of the knowledge with respect to how the agreement was developed, the timing of the agreement. Specifically, I want to respond to a couple of comments made. One question that was raised is, why do 19 have the right to determine the, I'll call it, strategy forward for others? And I don't think that's the case. I want to clarify that members will be members in this agreement, and then those who elect by choice their own not to be members will have a different pathway forward. Members will receive some benefits of membership and will have some responsibilities that come with membership to the stewardship group. Non-members will not have those, and I love choice. Choice is great, and you just have to do the personal calculation to determine which is in the best interest of your personal situation there.
Yeah, and to that end, I think, so first of all, let's just dispel the notion that dairies are responsible for the problem here. Most of the isotopic data analysis we have indicates the problem is caused by synthetic fertilizer applied to crops. So there's very little manure nitrogen. Now that's very different in Corcoran and in the Central Valley, some areas where we have the opposite sort of data. And that's really an aside. The idea here is you can participate as a member of this group. They've stepped forward and developed a scheme to provide replacement water, or not. And if you're not responsible for the problem in any way, there won't be any consequences for that. I mean, but that's a very challenging claim to make, because the basin is a big bathtub, and contributions have been made to it and mixed up over the years in such a way that it would be very hard to say that even 10 miles away from your agricultural operation, you're not having an influence, because you are. And when we did our individual enforcement actions in that context, the farmers that are adjacent to the contaminated wells, back in the day, they would say, my neighbors are contributing to this problem too, all the way along this way. And the gradients are not consistent in this basin either. And I'd say, well, tell me who they are, and we'll get them to help participate in the funding solution. Oh, no, I'm not going to do that. So, there's a certain approach here. There's a certain elegance to the fuzzy approach of not really pinpointing you are responsible for this. But if people want to elect that approach, they're certainly entitled to do that.
Okay, and another comment that I wanted to respond to, the question was, are farmers responsible for surrounding areas? And to some degree, you address that. If you cause or contribute the condition of pollution, you are responsible. If you are a landowner, you are responsible.
Yeah, so those are the legal categories of responsible persons for the contamination. So that's both the farm operator and the owner of the land upon which the farm is operating.
Or the condition of pollution.
Right, and so if you're a past operator and a discharge occurred during your operation, you're also responsible. current operator, past operator, current owner.
Now, can I just ask a question about that? It sounded like the outreach that's been going on has been outreach to farm operators by the different commodity groups and the different, the Farm Bureau, the grower shippers, et cetera. Are we doing separate outreach to the landowners?
It's been both. We used the county tax records. That was our first level of outreach. So it's been both, and frankly, at a point where we developed a certain size group of persons who wanted to continue negotiating, we focused instead on outreach with negotiation, right? Because initially, we had no idea whether we'd have any receptive parties.
Got it. But in terms of once there was an agreement, now that there is an agreement, and now that there is a deadline to join and people have to understand the agreement and the consequences one way or another, have we done outreach to landowners, or are we relying on the groups that represent farm operators to do the outreach to landowners as well?
Both. We've only done direct outreach to landowners at 600 acres and above in production. And then we're also relying up to this point, this Office of Enforcement has just done that. And then the trade groups, and then also the parties that are members of the stewardship group.
Because in my experience of I have had to deal with tracking down all the land ownership of what one of the biggest operators in the valley was doing at one point, and an awful lot of them are this family trust, that family trust. They're holding 60 acres or 100 acres, so it seems if we're intending to go after the landowners who do not participate, it seems like a gap in our outreach to assume that the associations of farm operators are going to contact the landowners, because they typically have that. That's just not their base.
Understood. I think we can take your earlier hint to heart and try to use the database for the enrollment to make a broader blast. And again, I think that's a further justification for the short extension. I'll just address the legal aspect of the enforcement is confusing. If it was confusing, I wouldn't want it. I feel pretty clear that I can enforce it. If you want to look at the language specifically that I'm talking about, in section 5.1, there's only a couple places where there's bold language in the entire agreement, except as provided for in section 5.2, then the immunities under the provision are to be interpreted broadly. That's the bold language. In 5.2, it says, without exception, section 5.1 does not restrict the board prosecutors from enforcement under the conditional waiver or division 7, which is 13304 of the water code, 13385 of the water code, 13360 of the water code, 13260, and 13367. So all the important provisions of enforcement in the water code. So, I mean, I built this so I could use it, and I'm pretty sure I can. Not that somebody's going to argue that I can't. I mean, that always happens, but I'm fairly firm in my confidence there. Also, with respect to confidentiality and the ambiguity of it, I'll tell you right now that data and the identity of persons is not confidential. I've never believed it was confidential, and I'd be more than happy to disclose it under the Public Records Act. I believe that the agreement is clear that the Public Record Act applies to this, and that means that anything that we have in our possession, custody, or control can be a public record unless it's otherwise subject to a privilege such as the attorney-client privilege. I represented to Mr. Schimmick earlier today that if he submitted a Public Record Act request to me, I would provide him with those records. So I don't feel this is in any way going to provide some sort of shielding from the identity of the parties. I mean, I'm dealing with a group that is fluid at this point, but I do know who some of the members are. It is documented in public records, and I'm more than happy to provide those upon request. And then with respect to the public process, I do agree that it would have been ideal for us to present this agreement in a more open public process. But in this context of this enforcement proceeding, and given the fact that we have this acute public health problem that we needed to address right away, we felt it was important to get the bottled water out there sooner rather than later. We will have an opportunity to fine-tune that. As John indicated, we'll be doing regular reports back to the board. And I think the key here is to have that robust public process in the context of the long-term solution that we would like to develop and implement and get going here so that, you know, that we're ready in 2 years to have that go. Now, if there is a need to extend the agreement, again, this is now a public agreement, and that would be, I think, something that would be subject to a robust public process. So ideally, that's something we would have done. Sometimes it's just you don't have the luxury of the time to go through that process, and that's the way this developed. John.
So I wanted to add that with respect to confidentiality, that's in Section 9 of the agreement, and 9.4 of the agreement was an addition that Chris and I kind of cobbled together, I think. And the lens through which I'm viewing that section is Zamora, because think about the timing of when this is happening. We're having the outfall of Zamora hit us, and what our responsibilities are and what the decision was. And so that's why that little subpiece came into existence and the expectation of public records. I want to acknowledge Mr. Schimek's comments, particularly comment number 3, which was about concerns about implementation. Interestingly, we've been having ongoing dialogue with the Environmental Justice Coalition for Water, I earlier mentioned, on a weekly, at least weekly basis. I know Mr. Schimek has had conversations with Environmental Justice Coalition for Water as well, and that is kind of the substance of those comments. And those also reflect internal conversations we're having. Like, we have to create an understanding and articulate the metrics. What does the target look like that is satisfactory implementation, or what do they look like, such that the stewardship group can aim and fire at the target? And that's an internal conversation that we've had. And I appreciate, and I will circle back to Mr. Schimek if he's still here and ask him to give me all of those. I could not write fast enough to acquire all of those implementation components and metrics and suggestions that he had, but I'm appreciative of those. I'm also aware of those, or collectively we as a team are aware of many of those and have had internal discussions about those. I think that's all I have to offer. Chris, you have anything else?
I covered my list.
Okay, me too. Okay.
All right, so what I'd like to do to, you know, move this item is I'm gonna start on my left, and I'm gonna ask my fellow board members to gather your final thoughts and questions, and then I will move then to my right after that. And basically bring this item to conclusion. Of course, it's not concluding because this is just the beginning. I think we all need to realize that, so we'll have more opportunities. And also, Mr. Robertson, you indicated you at our board meetings you will give us regular updates, and you know, you'll need to think of where you want to put those updates, either as VEO or in the cleanup updates. So I'll let you decide where you want to place hold that, but that should become sort of a standard item that we'll cover at our future meetings. So thank you.
I agree. I think that's part of the accountability loop too. So I agree, it should be a regular item.
Thank you. So I will start on my left, Ms. Grace.
Thank you. I presume that the frequent communication with the stewardship group will continue to occur on a weekly or biweekly basis, something of that nature.
Correct.
Okay.
We anticipate participating at least at the what we call the Monday morning call, potentially also at the leadership group call that exists on Wednesday mornings as well. And that's that dynamic adaptive management reality is, as we need to, we'll go in and be more assertive in making sure our voice is heard or our course correction that we need is made. And as they're consistent with what we need, you know, we'll dial that back.
And then with respect to ensuring that the landowners were contacted, you're confident that the extension to June 1st is sufficient time?
I'll speak from my end. I don't want to go indefinite there.
I agree.
That, you know, some folks have stepped up. And there needs to be the case for urgency here. Mm-hmm. I also want to reserve the right to say, based on the flow of incoming membership, let's reserve the right to maybe incrementally increase the window of opportunity a little bit more if the flow suggests that it should be.
Yeah, if it's justified.
Right.
Obviously. Yeah, I think the stewardship group's going to want that too, because the more members they have, obviously, the less burdensome the cost is. You know, the more to share in the denominator.
Agree. So I'm heartened by the leadership of the stewardship group and leadership at the board, and so I applaud your efforts and look forward to hearing updates. So thank you very much for your alacrity to this issue.
Mayor Delgado?
Yes, thank you. I think this is great because it gets safe water into businesses and homes that are entitled to it. I've talked to staff a little bit about this, and what I'm about to say is on the same line of thinking, but a little different. When you go to the bottom of page 2 on the staff report, under the paragraph entitled Negotiating a Larger Replacement Water Agreement, it talks about confidential settlement communication, settling our dispute, settlement negotiation. And in my few years here on the board, my understanding of enforcement is there's a violation, staff starts to issue either orders or ideas about how to cure the problem. And so in this case, where it says mid-paragraph, settling our dispute, what dispute is it referring to?
So we had a dispute with these parties over whether they were responsible for the contamination and obligated to provide replacement drinking water under Water Code Section 13304. And in fact, on the day that I walked in to talk with them, not one of them was persuaded that we had authority to issue an order under Water Code 13304, the draft order that I had provided. And so a dispute, which we strongly suspected would exist and still does exist with a substantial number of the operators, was have you caused or contributed to the contamination of the groundwater? And should you then be required to provide replacement water under Water Code 13304? That was the crux of the dispute, which we were able to resolve with some people, but not all.
So was it a formal dispute or an informal dispute?
Well, Water Code 13304 is an cleanup and abatement orders, and the component of water replacement, it is a form of enforcement. There are delegations in your office that allow the assistant executive officer to issue orders under that provision. And they go out, and it is an adjudicatory proceeding, not a legislative-type proceeding, where there are adverse parties. Although they may agree and settle the dispute right off the bat, it is an allegation of responsibility that is potentially contested between parties. And that's why we consider it enforcement action.
Okay, so is it fairly common to come to have these confidential settlement communications without notice of violations or without
In the context of Water Code 13304, it is. And also Water Code 13, the cease and desist order provisions will also have some confidential settlement dialogue and sometimes in advance in those contexts. So when you're adjudicating the rights of parties directly, it's fairly common under those to have a dialogue, a confidential dialogue.
Okay. So to put this into the context of my experience on this board, are there other situations where we've had this kind of confidential settlement negotiation come to the board after everything was completed?
Yes, many times.
Can you give me an example, please?
Greco waste pile case. Well, we failed in South San Luis Obispo, right. But we had several dialogues. Santa Cruz, Carpinteria. So the most of the enforcement actions, rather than that are substantial, rather than put out a public complaint for adjudication by the board in the first instance, we meet with the responsible party, and oftentimes we change some of the scope of our allegations based on additional information that they provide, which we may not have had in advance. And then we talk about the disputed issues that remain. So we kind of agree to certain things and then try to narrow down on the disputed issues that remain and try to reach a settlement. It's a way more efficient strategy for the resolution of disputes. And then oftentimes a stipulated order or a settlement agreement is presented to the board as a result of those confidential discussions. The reason we have confidential discussions is parties can be more candid about their potential responsibility without fear of reprisal in a discussion like that. Well, yeah, maybe we should have done a better job of training our operators, and maybe that lack of training did lead to this problem, but we do a good job in these other areas. Can't you consider that? What about this? Those are the kind of things that someone can't really say in front of the board. And so I think the settlement negotiation context, as a practical matter, leads to successful and equitable resolution of a lot more enforcement cases than just going straight to we've got our swords out and we're gonna rock and roll, so to speak.
Right, so I would add to that, thank you, Chris, I would add to that that for virtually every discretionary enforcement item, these are the non-mandatory minimum penalty items, discretionary enforcement items, that type of confidential negotiation does take place. We want it to take place because only a fraction of the enforcement items ultimately come before the board. The vast majority of them will settle at some point before they get to the board. And I think that's what we want in terms of efficiency. We're not in the business necessarily of just having hearings about enforcement. We want enforcement to achieve compliance, and sometimes we can do that at a lower cost through some sort of confidential settlement process. So, I'm now outside the discussions of confidential settlement, but I suspect 100% of discretionary enforcement actions have confidential settlement discussions.
All right.
I think that's the way we want it too.
Okay. Finally, I know that Taya and other staff have worked on the enforcement reports that are regularly a part of our agenda, and it seems like in that there's a public paper trail of violations or categories or specific violations that may or may not end up even being noticed as a violation, but there's like a little paper trail there. Those other examples, that list of five or six examples that have gone through this process that we just heard a couple minutes ago, did they have any kind of a public paper trail from their inception? And did this one have any kind of a public paper trail since its inception?
Most of them do have by a public paper trail, like a notice of violation or something like that. Yeah, I would say the vast majority, and I only qualify it because there might be one I can't think of. Specific to this one, I'll let Chris answer.
So there's a distinction between a penalty case where you're going to seek a civil liability associated with a violation. So we post violations in our public databases, and they can be tracked in that way. And then the board staff makes a decision about what kind of discretionary enforcement cases it's going to bring based on how serious the violation is, how many, kind of what's the history of violations at the facility, those kind of things. And then they bring a discretionary enforcement action, but the violations can be tracked. But those are for penalty cases. In an injunctive relief case like number 13304, where we want somebody to step forward and take an affirmative action, under Water Code 13304, there are two triggers to be responsible there. Either you have you've discharged waste or placed it where it's likely to be discharged in violation of a permit, or you've created a condition of pollution or nuisance by taking those actions. And so in this case, it's a you've created a condition of pollution or nuisance, right? Because these people aren't necessarily in violation of permits or haven't necessarily been in violation of permits, and we're not alleging that. So the inroad into our regulatory authority is that they've created this condition of pollution or nuisance, which, by the way, if there's contaminants above the MCL, that's a per se condition of pollution or an automatic condition of pollution or nuisance. So yes, there's a way to publicly track these. Normally in our enforcement settlement actions and under a Clean Water Act settlement for penalties, we have to provide a 30-day public comment period. And so the settlement agreement is up there, the allegations are up there, all the violations are up there, all those examples I provided to you before, that was the case. And then really if there's no significant public comment, the matter isn't really necessarily brought to the board. The board members would also have the opportunity to say, hey, I want to drill down more on this settlement agreement. I don't want the executive officer to sign this under his delegated authority. Let's talk about it at the public hearing. So anyone could bring one of those matters before the board by making comments during the public comment period, because that has to go through its process and there's an opportunity for the board to hear those or not. Many of the board, if you have a very high dollar volume settlement, or one where there's significant public comment, most of the boards take those off consent, or the board chairs don't exercise their delegated authority to sign settlement agreements and present those to the board. And I've had several of those in the last month in some of the other regions. With respect to this settlement, that's not how it went. We didn't have a public comment period. John exercised his discretion to sign the settlement agreement. As did John Bishop on behalf of the Division of Drinking Water. So there's sort of a dual, that's why we're so connected on this. Sorry, it's a long-winded answer, but it's a complicated question.
No, I love it. Thank you for the education. So to follow up, that list of 5 to 7 other similar issues, were they differently handled than this one? Or were they similarly as far as confidentiality?
The confidential negotiations were handled differently, but since they were penalty actions, we noticed them for public comment as required by the Clean Water Act after the settlement was reached. And if you look back over the last maybe year at the board's webpage and records, you probably find 15 discretionary actions that were settled in that way after public comment. Under Water Code 13304, we don't necessarily do that. And part of the reason is that the regional board might be called upon to adjudicate under a discretionary appeal a Water Code Section 13304 order. So, okay.
So are there other examples of 13304 injunctive relief cases in the last several years like this one, or is this one different?
What'd we do in San Lucas? The order got issued. I don't believe there was a public comment period, so that case went as this one did. Yeah, so in the San Lucas case, it was negotiated in the same way. The order was signed. I don't believe there was a public comment period.
Okay, so there is precedent in the recent years that are similar to this issue.
Yes, correct.
As far as confidentiality.
Yeah. And,
and that's the San Lucas case.
Yes.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Ms. Cervantes?
I had a question regarding how this agreement affects existing interim replacement water agreements. I'm specifically wondering about what Dr. Hunter mentioned in her report yesterday with some of the communities in this very area where the funding will be ending after June in terms of their interim water replacement.
So I think Dr. Hunter's report was in reference to
Las Lomas and Johnson Road.
Right, right. Okay. So that is outside the blue footprint. It doesn't mitigate the need to figure out where replacement water funding is coming from after our grant expires, but it sits outside the footprint of this agreement.
So we do have existing agreements, and by this I mean agreements with both UCLA and with Environmental Justice Coalition for Water that are grant-funded agreements to provide replacement water. And our approach is to try to transition as smoothly as possible into the stewardship group paying for that as opposed to the public paying for that, but without interrupting service. And so that's our main goal. The second objective is to shift the burden of funding from the public to the stewardship group.
So I think earlier I mentioned that Environmental Justice Coalition for Water serves six communities that are within the footprint of the agreement. And kind of adding on to what Chris just said, that appears to be low-hanging fruit. The groundwork has already been done in those communities to identify who and how much water is needed. Now it seems like, if I'm not missing anything, seems like who pays for it is the answer or the simple solution here. We can change who pays for it from a grant to the stewardship group now. But the real difficult, complex work of who and how much is already done. So to me, that feels like a quick transitional low-hanging fruit option for us with respect to the Environmental Justice Coalition for Waters grant. UCLA, I also alluded to a little earlier, is trickier because UCLA, the goal of their project is more of a long-term replacement water solution, and it won't manifest immediately like bottled water can. And so there is this transitional period, and UCLA needs to be well-informed such that they can communicate effectively to the communities they're working in how to respond to requests for replacement short-term replacement water, typically bottled water, in light of the knowledge in the community that long-term replacement water is coming via the UCLA pilot project. That's a more complex choreography there and communication pathway, I think. And that is on us and on the stewardship group leadership and implementing folks to help inform UCLA so that they can get the word out to the communities, the three communities they're working in.
Thank you.
And then I also remember reading in the staff report regarding the possibility, so the big sort of word here being might, that there could be an opportunity or might be an opportunity for seeing some investment in actual treatment systems in addition to the interim replacement water. So would that be an option moving into year two to see something of that more concretely?
So, Chris, I'll ask you to add in, but I'll take the first shot at this. So at the my understanding is that at the stewardship group's behest, the option for reverse osmosis, typically a point of use, which is the fancy $5 way of saying under the countertop, reverse osmosis, you know, right next to your faucet, be an available option, not just singularly using bottled water as a replacement water option. So that option is available. I'm not sure it's, I think everything in this agreement is viewed in a relatively short-term context, viewing this agreement as a bridge to that longer umbrella legislative funding thing that sits out hopefully somewhere in the not too distant future. But the stewardship group wanted to have an additional strategy to implement. It might just make more sense to use the under the counter RO solution and have a maintenance contract attached to that instead of always delivering bottled water to a household.
So it's at their option, and I don't expect they'll be working on treatment technologies or installation of treatment systems in this under this two-year period.
Right.
And that's why we wanted it to be 2 years. And, you know, so I mean, the pressure's on for them to look at that and to start planning for the future and develop a way to fund planning for the future. But I don't see treatment alternatives being developed as a result of this agreement.
And not at the scale that is at the top of a wellhead, you know, sort of a community size treatment system. I don't see that happening either.
All right, Dr. Hunter.
Thank you, folks. It's really encouraging, very encouraging. In fact, as we've this board in particular has been looking at the short term, the bridge, and we've invested funds from settlement monies. We've moved Matt Keeling in particular, Angela Schroeder, number of staff have really taken part in significant actions that are either statewide or region focused, and we've also supported the Office of Public Participation and GIDA's efforts. So this is really important to see this coming together. And I applaud the farmers that are stepping forward voluntarily. Again, that is so important to see the leadership within the farm community itself define what their role is and how they want to see this go forward and make a contribution towards solutions. So this is enormous. So I have two areas of that I want just a little bit more clarity on. First, my understanding is the verification process is underway now, which is an effort to beyond the legwork that has already been done either through irrigated ag data or through efforts like EJCW, where we know where the contamination is occurring and we know replacement water is needed. And I know, so the verification process is one of then identifying additionally searching out where these potential wells and small systems are located. What's the timeline for that? Is that a 1 year or 2 year, or is that ongoing?
I'll see the expectation for that, and let me throw my glasses on and mm-hmm. I will jump back on a slide here. So the expectation for that, I was going to take us back to the slide that talks about the what's in the agreement.
Mm-hmm.
And just one more slide. Right here. So the second bullet in year one, I think, kind of gets at this. The expectation is that the stewardship group will have a plan. They'll develop a plan and get it approved by the water boards. And included in that plan is a pathway to identify domestic wells. That's the donut hole right there. That's the real mm-hmm. challenge. They're not regulated, despite comments earlier. The water quality associated in domestic wells is not regulated after the point of installation.
Right.
So you can drink, you should know what you're drinking mm-hmm. if you're in a domestic well mm-hmm. environment. Finding domestic wells is a challenge throughout the region and throughout the state. Where are they? Because they're not regulated in the traditional sense of a small system, they're not regularly visited, and their water quality is not regularly monitored. Mm-hmm. And so an important part of that plan will be the plan to identify location of domestic wells in the four sub-basins that are part of the agreement.
So.
And we've actually had internal conversation, and we'll play that out a little bit to the stewardship group in time. I didn't want to overly induce complexity in our early conversations. Get them start worrying about. We can worry about that in a little bit. We need to worry about effective outreach right now, but in the future, not too distant, we need to start figuring out how are we going to tackle the issue of identifying location and then initiating dialogue outreach to domestic wells. And Chris and I and Angela and Angelis have started that dialogue just at the internal level right now. And Chris mentioned some money he needs to spend before he retires. And I think that is a great place. And we've got analogous projects going on in Santa Barbara County about identifying domestic wells and understanding the contact information associated with those. So I think there's some good opportunity here.
The verification work on the 58 systems is underway, and we expect that to be completed, or not necessarily completed, but probably the first half of it completed in 30 days. And then, the rest of it's going to be picked up probably over the next 60 days after that, as the more difficult systems to reach through present themselves. They've already done verification sampling at, I think, 3 to 5 of the systems, right, that responded to their initial inquiry. So that's underway, and they're working on that now. Two different strategies for the different regulated versus unregulated.
Okay, that helps. And then the second part, there's probably not an answer right now. I'm going to guess, but I'm going to put it out there. And I'm hoping that we see a lot of detail on this in your updates, Mr. Robertson. And that concerns the assessment of needs. So maybe based on what EJCW, the procedure that they use for once they engaged a family that was willing to accept the replacement water, how did they determine what factors were involved, how many residents, what level of health needs, other determining factors that would affect how much water supply they received, the frequency of water, and the mode of delivery, whether it's bottles, which would be certainly appreciated, but I can't imagine living with water. A bottle of water is my only source of water. I mean, maybe larger 5-gallon containers. I don't know what the possibilities, what the range is. And then elderly and disabled, what kind of needs do they have that might call for special circumstances to make sure that there is a true response to what their water needs are. So I'm hoping that the plan will address that and that we'll hear more as more is determined.
Yes.
Thank you. Mr. Johnson?
All right. Pass.
All right. Thank you. So I want to thank all my colleagues for, in-depth review of this program. And, I look at it since we're talking about water analogy. I don't see this as being the glass half full. I see it as 3/4 full by having, folks coming forward to be part of a solution. But from that perspective, I would like at some time and point to have a face to a voice, because right now we see a stewardship group, and it's a name. I would have loved to see at least one of the representatives here today, because it's a little odd that there's a lot of conversation on their behalf. So I would like to see at some time and point representation of a stewardship coming at this meeting. It would be great actually to hear from them, the feedback on how things are going. And likewise, the contractors that they use, because the contractors are an important link to the success of the implementation. So that would be my kind of contribution to my colleagues.
I was remiss in not extending regrets on behalf of the board members, and they are scrambling to sign up new members today, mm-hmm. as it is kind of, they initially thinking it was the last day and weren't certain whether there'd be an extension, and I'm certain that they will be probably at your next meeting.
Yeah.
I want to assure you, we extended that offer. I personally extended it to several members of the leadership team. And as I often do, I said, you know, strategically, it makes a lot of sense for you just to show up. It's just an opportunity to ingratiate yourself to the board. Mm-hmm. And at the time, I think they felt like they were going to show up. And I don't know if anybody from the board or from the membership group is here, but I will reiterate that request and comment to them.
Yeah, and I think it has worked very well with, you know, other examples of a coalition where we do get updates, and so that would be my suggestion to strengthen the relationships. So thank you very much. I think this should, unless you have one more item, give you one more bite at the apple.
No, I'm ready to move on to the last agenda item.
And the last agenda item is going to be after lunch.
Okay.
So because we have probably, I'm going to say a good hour to.
Okay.
And that would bring us quite far behind. So your suggestion, Mr. Robertson, time-wise, could we do 45 minutes?
Absolutely.
It's not far from here where you can have lunch.
Right,
there's
absolutely.
A little shopping center. So we reconvene in 45 minutes. So let's make it at, 20 past 1. Okay? Thank you.